Today, New Letters on the Air features the augurs, women of an age. Referencing the wisdom speakers of ancient Rome, these poets call on their maturity to offer insights into our culture and times. This was an offsite event in 2017 during AWP, the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference. I'm Angela Elam, and I recorded this at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C., under the auspices of the Association of Literary Scholars, Critics, and Writers. Here's a portion, beginning with then-President and Catholic University Professor Ernest Suarez.
The Association of Literary Scholars, Critics, and Writers was started in 1994. About half our membership is creative writers. We have a wide array of people. We have scientists. We have two NASA astronauts. But we have editors, agents, so people from all walks of life. It's an organization that's about literature. A big effort that we're making is to make sure the National Endowment of the Humanities and the National Endowment of the Arts keep going. We're trying to do every single thing that we can possibly do to keep literature and the arts thriving. One of my huge initiatives as president is to try to push English departments, all literature departments, make them see the wisdom of hiring people who are both creative writers and critics in order to restore a sense of craft to our profession. This event is perfect to have here. Catholic University is a place where you don't have to defend the humanities. It's just a given that humanities and liberal arts education are at the center of anyone's education. Enjoy. Let's dig in. Let's listen to some poetry. Thank you.
To kick off the reading, here's MacArthur Fellow Eleanor Wilner.
This is my poem for the muse. It mentions a couple of things. One is Lacan, who is a French literary theorist who has confused symbol making with a certain part of the male anatomy. And the other reference is to Alexander and the story of the Gordian knot. You know the story where the high priestess had tied a knot so intricate that the man who could untie it would become the ruler of the world. Alexander took his sword and cut it in two, thereby setting the problem solving of the West from that day to Okay. The muse. There she was for centuries, the big broad with the luscious tits, the secret smile, a toga of translucent silk, cool hand on the shoulder of the suffering poet, the tease who made him squeeze those great words out. He was the mirror and the lamp. She, the torch, who burned with the blue butane of a pure refusal, too good for mortal use. Her breath was cold as mountain streams, the chill of the eternal, no hint of plaque or any odor of decay. Ethereal as hell, a spirit in chiffon. The mystery is how she had got so rounded in the butt and all her better parts as soft as butter. Why such a wraith should be so ample. What her endowments had to do with that for which she set example. All this was surely mystery. Oh, that elusive object of desire, that untouched bride of quietness, that plump poetic dish who lived on air but looked as if she dined on pasta. Basta, a pox on the great Lacan who writes with his eraser. On all poetic graces, mute and pensive, concave exactly where he is most extensive. Oh, look what she has not that he has got. A thing I'm too polite to mention, except to say it rhymes with Venus. It was the Latin word for tail. Its root, therefore, is not the same as pen, which comes from the word for feather. But enough of these fine distinctions. What a great tradition was born when Alexander whipped his penknife out, cut the knot she carefully had tied, leaped on his mount, a perfect straddle, and let the crotch decide who was the horse and who was the rider, who was the muse and who the writer.
The Muse by Eleanor Wilner, included in her book of new and selected poems called Reversing the Spell. Though Wilner's joy in life is also apparent in her seventh collection, Tourist in Hell, this work confronts the horrors and repetitions of war throughout history. Our next poet, Alicia Ostreicher, a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, looks back as well with a poem from her 2017 book, Waiting for the Light.
I'm going to read this longish poem, which is also about our time and times. It's called Temblor, and it's got a little epigraph by Catherine Schultz, which I read in The New Yorker, that just said, "The earth snapped. At the edge of the world, California has all one needs, unlimited sea and sand, mountains and sky above, canyons, vineyards, and the fault zone. Moonrise over dunes, long shadows, dry heat departing. And in her room, a woman leans toward a screen, learning about some beheadings performed by men who have surrendered to a god with a sword. Because surrender to a god is like the swoon of a girl. The pain of living becomes so sweet. And if there is a sword, all the better. Get your hands on an Uzi. You will show those infidels what faith is." The woman is trying to understand their frenzy. A crack in earth, a crust, then a body dragged beneath it. Decades since the bus from Boston to Alabama, a summer of love, of justice, discipline, and fear, the toilet smell of the sheriff's breath, scent of magnolia and honey baby sweat, kids chanting, "Hell no, we won't go," peace signs like an encoded seraphic message everyone got, and now only the impulse to hurl things at the screen when the talking heads come on saying, "Nuke 'em!" They spread their thick owl wings. They twitch their coyote noses. She's a rabbit in the harsh grass, paralyzed. And she knows that in less than 3 seconds, there will be a commercial for cars, then one for a cosmetic product, then one for a congressman, while the wars cough up dictionaries of amnesia. Crack in her mind, unrelenting pressure beneath it. To the naked eye, the motions of earth are imperceptible. The plates sliding north at the rate her fingernails grow. From the air, no hint of violence, rather a long, wrinkled scar, looking old and harmless like herself. But where the fault bends, the grinding proceeds. She wonders why she imagines killing the killers, when her deep heart's core wants peace and linnet's wings, not owls. Yet she sometimes pictures driving her car into a wall or into a crowd. And she likes the fun of throwing glass things, wine bottles, into the yellow recycle pail to hear them crash. She likes tugging weeds up by muddy roots. Dear aged lady, whose garbage will be picked up for a monthly fee, sorted and buried or burnt far away. Against havoc, to join committees, to march, to sing, slowly to come, to understand, to write, to raise your voice against the compulsive lie? Do these slight geological tremors satisfy your craving to change the laws of history, to speak the unspoken? Do they pacify your stifled impulse to murder the Secretary of Defense? The moon still rises with the serenity of a duchess. The coyotes still trot through the sagebrush in that eerie light. Their eyes penetrate shadows. They lift their voices in an ancient song. The wind blows wherever it wants to. The television confidently sneers. The sea is never full. Back and forth it daily slides, sandpipers dancing at its edge. And your poetry also makes nothing happen, except among the synapses that are whispering, only connect to each other. And the desperate force inside each crying, break.
Alicia Ostreicher reading Tembler from her 15th poetry book, Waiting for the Light. You're listening to The Augers, Women of an Age, a special edition of New Letters on the Air. Our next reader has been consumed by an Irish poet born in 1874 who lived in Australia and New Zealand before settling in San Francisco in 1908, where her first book, The Ghetto and Other Poems, was published a decade later and made the cover of The New Republic with H.G. Wells. Here's her tribute to the poet with some insights into those turbulent times in the U.S.
I'm Therese Swoboda. I published this book, Anything That Burns You, a portrait of Lola Ridge, radical poet, last year. The New York Times said she was one of the best poets in America in 1941, but she was forgotten because of anti-feminism, anti-radicalism, and anti-experimentalism. So this poem, it was a result of some of that research. I ran across something in Google, which I mentioned was shocking to me. This is Red Summer, 1919. It starts in 1917. However, the epigraph is from Josephine Baker, who was age 11 at the time. She said, "Is that a storm coming?" And her mother said, "It's the whites." After they drag her off the streetcar, black women, many, on a rampage, hat pin the white girl's blue eyes, jerk the baby out of her arms, throw it into the river, then beat the girl to death with their shoe heels. Whites swim that river as hard as they can, past the corpses, gulping trash water, while blacks shoot at them like carp. Some make it across to black kids who stone them. Whites, wounded, try the door, any door. Inside, blacks clear the table to pray. Outside, a wild mob shouts, "Out or we'll set you afire." They turn them out. The ambulance drivers leave the wounded white man to be thrown into his own burning house. Except black is white. 1917. Ida B. Wells' report stayed sealed until 1986. East St. Louis. You ever heard of East St. Louis? Not St. Louis. A place grown too fast, filled with Southerners, fought over, then left to the boll weevil. Boll weevil stew. There's trains that stop in St. Louis. There's work since the pacifist president talked up war. There's unions trying to exclude the blacks. Whites cut the fire hoses, shooting blacks who fled the flames. I don't care who started it. 10,000 marched in New York City, men in black, the women in white, all races, in memoriam. So, 64 lynchings the next year, then Red Summer. Oh, we have commies to blame for that, agitators. Who needed agitators? In new blue cotton work pants to hide behind, not men disguised in white peaked sheets. And let's not forget, we have not forgotten, the women who wash the sheets. An American way of life, a good wage. the robber barons, their untaxed, undead corporate contemporaries. Here's a quote from Marcus Garvey of the time. Black people seeking an industrial chance in a country that they have labored for 300 years to make great. During Red Summer, 14 cities burned. I was naive. I said, our melting pot works. What's with the Iraqis, the Burmese, the Sri Lankans, all those Africans? Nobody sent out press releases on the extermination of Tulsa's Black Wall Street, 1921, oil rich, bombed from the air with dynamite and nitro, 10,000 homeless. I've already forgotten the Google that drew me in. Negro boy stoned for drifting into whites-only water. Chicago, 1919. The quiet Midwest, a week of killing. Did the St. Louis women pin their hats back on? Oh, and East St. Louis is Ferguson.
Therese Swoboda, a 2013 Guggenheim Fellow reading Red Summer 1919. Her 2016 poetry book, Professor Harriman's Steam Airship, followed the year after her selected in New Poems, When the Next Big War Blows Down the Valley. This is New Letters on the Air with the Augers, Women of an Age. Next, we'll head south with Kate Daniels, winner of the 2011 Haynes Poetry Award from the Fellowship of Southern Writers. Poetry in her book, A Walk in Victoria's Secret, appeared in Best American Poetry 2010. Here's a little something from that collection.
My poem is a very imperfect sonnet. Like so many, I've been in a rage and, you know, a fever of despair for weeks and weeks and weeks now. So this is a poem I wrote years ago. It's about mold. I lived in South Louisiana for a while. I never really thought about mold before, and then discovered that mold, which sort of starts out very invisibly, has extraordinary powers. In an uninsulated closet, it can eat up your suede shoes or your suede jacket in a couple of days. It gets into your box spring. It can destroy it within a very short period of time. So this is a comment, a metaphorical, elliptical comment on what the hell is going on and where we find ourselves. Louisiana, late summer. Because our bodies have been claimed by humidity, we walk around in our heads in the heat, squatting in the back room to paint a baseboard, sweat pouring down in fragrant runs, the ghosts of different body parts asserting themselves with distinctive odors. Overhead, a fan twirls lackadaisically, collecting spores. Far back in the closet, a light mold, transported here by some primeval wind, festers on the toe of a suede shoe. It pours its cheap mold life into ignominy and plans the destruction of the entire world.
Kate Daniels, Louisiana, Late Summer. Next, a 2012 Georgia Author of the Year unleashes more mythology.
My name is Alice Fryman. I guess we're all sort of like in the same boat here, which is very, very comforting. I have been miserable all year. What is the first step of after somebody dies? Denial? Rage? I am in that, and I don't intend to get out of it for the next 4 years. At any rate, I found myself this spring and summer writing poems about murder. I usually write about trees, but I have written a series of murder poems, and they were very satisfying to write. So I would like to read you one. This is called Clytemnestra Unleashed. And if you need a little refresher course, you know that Clytemnestra was the forced wife of Agamemnon, who waited 10 years to pay him back. I don't know about you, there's mostly women here, but I have spent my whole life waiting. I think women wait. Clytemnestra Unleashed. Lovingly, she poured the scented water into his bath. helped him off with his robe, planting little kisses across his back, then shot the bolt home and went at him with an axe. His left foot she grabbed first, then sloshing forward on her knees, crawled over the fallen mountain of his body, hacking away. When the job was done, she stood before the palace doors, dripping righteous in the red evidence of her vengeance. Always the simmering question, what to do with her life? The endless waiting for what the oracle promised, what the stars writ large. One thing she knew, the jailhouse pacing on the parapets would stop, the dry winds from the east that brought no news would stop. For now at last the giddy joy of action, breathing hard, the sticky handle of the chopper she'll not put down. Curse by curse, rattle by rattle, the press of bones piled up behind her, scraping and jostling for attention. Time to clean out this house, sacrifice for sacrifice, murder for murder. Her lover hid in the closet, the deed, he said, being woman's work. Who could blame her? Even the grand coulee dam, holding back and filled to choking, would crack, groan, and yawn open, foaming through the rift its anger that leaps and rages, churning the carcass of a life into a high red boil of blood, woman's blood, unclenched, unyielding, and unbuttoned. You better believe it.
Alice Fryman, reading Clytemnestra Unleashed. You can read four other new poems by her in the jazz issue of New Letters magazine. She's also been featured on New Letters on the Air, and our shop has an Alice Fryman collection of audio and books at newletters.org. Our archives also contain full interviews with the last three of these poets in the Auger's Women of an Age. Here's Rosellen Brown, the 2016 Chicago Literary Hall of Fame's Fuller Award winner for Lifetime Achievement.
I wrote a book a long, long time ago called Cora Fry, which is the voice of a New Hampshire woman in a small town. One of the characters in it, among many, is her little son Chip, who's a very small boy in the first book. And then 18 years later, I wrote a sequel, and they were both published together as Cora Fry's Pillow Book. And this is a poem about Cora confronting her son Chip, who is now grown. They need a sign. No mothers in the body shop. I call out Chip, and my voice is a dropped wrench, loud as I can make it in the dead light, motes swirling, standing still, caught in its oil, black rags, sour iron smell, the hissing and clanging. Through it all, I can barely make out his features, and he turns away in a rage. I call out to him again, but he is so ashamed of my softness here, as if they are his fault, my breasts. I know it, my hips in worn blue cotton, my hair that fuzzes at my neck, inviting breakage, broken already. Everything in here is harder than I am. The tool's thick surfaces, the machines chuffing that eat the bolts off tires, the dangle of fan belts cluttered on the wall behind him, and nozzles like parts of his body I mustn't see anymore. He is embarrassed for himself, so reduced. Not for me, this is, for himself and the others. For Jimmy, back in the office, and Horace, out front, pumping gas, gabbing. For baby Fitz, who just last week married his pregnant sweetheart, and she's already guilty as I am, swelling up in secret, scaring the boy half to death. When I talk to my son, he hits a button, and a silver car rises and rises between us on a hard oiled stalk. He keeps to the other side of it, poking its underparts. He is the only man in the shop, of course, who came out of such a delicate darkness as mine. The only one who cried when they lifted him up from his bloody nest, lunging and gasping, as if he was born cold as a wrench or a hammer, slicked shiny with motor grease, as if I was ever as fragile as he thinks I am today.
From Cora Fry's Pillow Book by Rosellen Brown. Next, a former Pennsylvania State University poet laureate.
Hi, I'm Robin Becker, and I'm going to read a poem called Dyke. The word came after me, then hid each time I turned to look at it. It breathed in the hedge. I could hear it bite and snap the air. I feared the woman with slicked back hair sitting on a bar stool, her back to the dance floor, a beer in her hands. Disco drove the word away, but it came back. Bull dyke, bull dagger. What did the word want with me? And why this dread, this desire? This dangerous butch striding through Kenmore Square, uncamouflaged. Dyke had a spike in it, a cleated surge. In leathers, the word leapt 18th century grillwork on the Boston Common and led the parade around the city. The slow, snaking, joyful motorcade of a new millennium. First, I had to hate her. Then I had to hurt her. The rest of my life, I ate from her hand. Thank you.
Dyke by Robin Becker, poetry editor of the Women's Review of Books from her 2014 collection, Tiger Heron. We'll finish the Augers Women of an Age with the now late Michelle Boisseau, a 2017 Guggenheim Poetry Fellow who organized this reading.
I've really been juggling with what to do. I think a lot of base has been covered, but in the spirit of things, this is one that hasn't really been covered. 92-year-old nude descending a staircase. A blur ago, I was taking the steps at Penn Station 2-3 at a time, a tripod slung over my shoulder, muscling around soldier boys, fur coats and galoshes, my freckles, the gloss of that hair. Now my belly pleats and spreads like an alluvial fan. After the river rushes through the Spice Mountains, it has time to collect a continent's silt. Sex is a struck gong rolling its waves ever onward. This is my body of evidence. Its jurisdiction grows like nebula.
The late Michelle Boisseau, reading from her fifth book, Among the Gorgons, at the Catholic University in D.C. during the 2017 AWP conference. She died that November. A tribute to her will take place at the 2018 AWP in Tampa. For links to this and to hear interviews with Michelle Boisseau and some of the other poets you heard today, visit newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today's show was produced with Mackenzie Callahan, Blake Elizondo, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.